Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm Chris Kington Barker. Two recent studies ranked San Luis Obispo County the 5th and 7th least affordable housing market in the nation. The most recent Action Vital Signs report found 59% of San Luis Obispo residents reported spending one-third or more of their household income on housing costs in 2016. Safe, stable, affordable housing is central to the health and vitality of a community. A shortage of affordable housing is not only causes distress and hardship for individuals and families as they struggle to meet their basic needs, but it will also affect local companies and organizations and creates difficulty in retaining and recruiting qualified employees, impacting the larger community as a whole. My guests today are James Worthley, Regional Planning Division Chief for the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments, or otherwise known as SLOCOG, and Michael Hopkins Tucker, Policy Analyst, People Self-Help Housing, to discuss how housing policy impacts individuals and the community and the most important implications of housing policy on the Central Coast. You're invited to participate in our conversation today and call in to be a part of our discussion, and you can do that by calling us at 805-781-3875. Again, if you want to be a part of the discussion by bringing your questions to today's conversation, you can call us at 805-781-3875. And gentlemen, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
So this is something that keeps popping up. I know those two articles popped up about the least affordable places. We're ranking, you know, we're not only a happy place, but apparently we're happy to be unaffordable. What qualifies us as affordable housing or unaffordable housing?
Well, very broadly speaking, affordable housing is considered paying under 30% or less of your income on rent. It can have more technical definitions, such as deed-restricted affordable housing, which is typically subsidized in some fashion or another that is supposed to target more vulnerable populations. But more generally speaking, when we're talking about affordable housing, it needs to be under 30% of your income housing costs.
Yeah, it was interesting that the report was talking about putting us right up there with San Francisco, New York, Marin County, right? Santa Barbara was actually behind us. We were 7th, I think, 5th and 7th, and they were 18th. And that was attributable, I think, because they are also inclusive of Santa Maria and Guadalupe. And Guadalupe right now and Santa Maria are doing a lot of building for homes that have a lower price point than certainly we do in this county.
Right. And those studies you cited, too, I think are important to consider because they actually do look at income as a function of housing cost and consider both against each other, which I think is you know, critical to this discussion is, you know, median price of a home is only matters within that context of income.
Yeah. So does that mean then that if you look at communities, for instance, in the Midwest that may have lower incomes, the cost of housing is lower, they're taking into consideration it's 30% of the income of that
correct
earning in that community rather than as a whole.
Right.
Yeah. And the average income, I think, here that they came up with was something around 80,000. And this is per family, correct? This is not per individual.
Right. Well, it's when we're talking about this, we're normally talking about a four-person household. So assuming, okay, you know, typically two parents and two dependents.
Right, right.
But when we're looking at this more specifically, when in the terms of affordable housing, when they're calculating income, it is based on household size. So it can be adjusted both up and down to what is considered affordable for a single person household and mm-hmm. what's considered affordable up to, you know, an 8-person household. It's going to be variable.
I was really curious when they do these kinds of surveys, do they factor out populations? For instance, do they factor out students? Do they factor out California Men's Colony? I mean, you have large populations that live in those places.
Right. I can speak a little bit to the student population. Mm-hmm. When there's often poverty measures of the states coming out with this new areas of high opportunity, which basically looks at trying to put affordable housing in communities where if families are put in that community, they'll be able to succeed based on better schools, more supportive environments, maybe better jobs. And actually, as a result of college populations, they looked at areas like San Luis Obispo, Isla Vista around Santa Barbara,
right.
And they determined them to be areas of high segregation and poverty. And until we kind of point out to the state, look, this is a student population with...
they're supposed to be poor, right?
Well, to be fair, there are a lot of students that suffer from that food insecurity, housing insecurity.
Correct. Homelessness.
Homelessness, exactly.
Yes.
But, you know, there needs to be a little bit of an adjuster there for those student populations. So mm-hmm. they are considered in those models.
So those are factored in. Yeah.
They're starting to be.
yeah. Okay. and when we talk about the affordable housing, where does that money come from?
It comes from a wide variety of sources, but the largest producer or largest contributor to affordable housing projects that we're talking about, strictly deed-restricted affordable housing, which is a very narrow type of affordable housing.
Okay.
The financing is coming through a program called the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program, which was developed as a function of tax reform in 1986, actually under President Reagan. And this program provides a tax credit benefit towards major investors. And so they can provide equity up front to partially subsidize these projects, and they get a long-term tax benefit as a result. And it's a bipartisan supported program, has a strong history of congressional support, and has definitely produced the most new construction units out of any other program. But there's also sources from the state, and then local government sources are actually the most important when considering this model, because it's actually the smallest amount of money usually contributed to these types of housing developments, but it can be the most important because it serves as seed funding to leverage against those other resources. And so when all is said and done, actually a majority of the financing for these projects is actually usually private investment through the tax credits, and these projects usually take on regular market rate loans as well. So they're only really partially subsidized to get the rents to be affordable. And then that affordability is preserved for anywhere from 50 to 55 years.
Okay. So, I'm going to go back. I'm going to go back over to you and ask you what the regional housing needs allocation process is, because that's such a big. It sounds like a big.
It is a big thing.
It sounds like a big thing, and we hear about that. And honestly, I'm confused about it.
And you're not alone.
Okay, good. Thank you for that.
I'm sure there are a lot of people that are confused about what this is. It's a process that the state implemented to encourage or require local jurisdictions to zone adequate land for new housing. So the process that is set up right now is the state or the Housing and Community Development Department determines the number of units that is needed over the next 10 years mm-hmm. within our county. So they work with the Department of Finance. They project new populations. They discount group quarters, people that live in dormitories, for instance, at Cal Poly.
Okay.
They don't count toward needing new housing because there's dormitories for
right.
them. So they create this projection, and they offer that projection down to SLOCOG or regional agencies like ours to then identify a methodology to distribute those units to our member jurisdictions, our 8 jurisdictions, 7 cities and 1 county. So we developed 9 methodologies, actually, reviewed those with our stakeholder group, our ARENA team.
What's ARENA team?
ARENA team, Regional Housing Needs Allocation Team. So we get together with representatives of each of the city staff, the county staff, as well as Cal Poly and LAFCO were involved to help craft what the methodologies might look like, and then help to define which one they'd recommend to our board. Our board then reviews these 9 methodologies, takes recommendations, and they actually identified one of them to move forward with back in December. That methodology then is reviewed by during a public comment period that closed at the beginning of February, and our board adopted a single methodology to distribute the total number of units. So in this instance, HCD was looking at 10 years. They identified a need for almost 11,000 units over that 10-year period for the entire region. So just under 1,100 units per year, if you want to look at it that way. This is about 50% higher than what we had in our last RENA cycle. That was in the neighborhood of 700, 750 units per year.
And the reason for the increase? Because more people have moved into the...
No, it actually is the state is changing its...
Formula?
Well, I don't think it's changing the formula, but they are trying to encourage more housing opportunities.
Okay.
So HCD doesn't build housing. SLOCOG doesn't build the housing. And the once SLOCOG is done with the methodology, then the cities and the county all know about how many units they need to plan over the next housing cycle. So they develop their housing elements. And their housing elements are probably going to start developing with public input over the next year and a half, almost 2 years. They all need to be completed by the end of 2020. End of 2020. So they have 18 months, a little bit more than 18 months now to develop them using these numbers.
Okay. So the first 1,100 need to be built by the end of 2020?
No, it doesn't, it doesn't have to be 10%. Over the, each oh, of the okay. 10 years. It can be, I think they'll check in at about the fourth year or the fifth year mark to see how we're doing and encourage or discourage, I guess the state would be encouraging, making sure that there is opportunities to build. Now, the housing elements don't build housing. They only offer opportunities to build housing.
And so define how the opportunities are offered.
So to accommodate the new number of units that each jurisdiction may get, they might have to look at a rezoning or annexation or a combination of both.
Okay, so explain for those of us that don't understand that because we're not builders and we're not, you know, we're used to driving down the street, picking out a house, finding one we can afford, saying, I could live with this, and moving in. What would rezoning be?
So, for instance, you might be driving down the street. You might see a large lot that's open, and maybe it's 4 acres, and mm-hmm. it says for sale.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, the zone for it is one unit on those 4 acres.
Right, one home.
One home.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's the potential that the jurisdiction that has that control of the land use could say, you know, maybe one unit on those 4 acres isn't the best use of those 4 acres.
Right.
Let's increase it to one home per acre, so there's 4 homes.
Okay.
Or let's increase it to 10 units for those 4 acres.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the smaller the lot, the cheaper the land cost for each home then, correct?
Got it. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And so if there was rezoning, practically, what would it take to get something rezoned?
That's a better question for one of our local jurisdictions than it is for the regional agency.
Right.
But I think the starting point is looking at the housing elements and developing the housing elements to first accommodate the new growth.
Okay.
And
that's your role as SLOCOG?
Not the housing elements, no.
Not the
we
housing
just do
elements.
The regional housing needs allocation plan.
Okay. So you say this is what the need is.
Actually, the state tells us this is what the need is in the region.
And you guys say
we work as the middleman to negotiate with our local jurisdictions and identify, well, what's the best distribution of this total number to the 8 jurisdictions.
So the jurisdictions are what?
So the 7 cities and the county. So Arroyo Grande, Atascadero, Morro Bay, Grover Beach, Paso Robles, San Luis Obispo, and Pismo Beach.
Okay, so you're going to look at density, right?
So, not for the RENA plan, no.
Okay. What do you look at for distribution?
So, for distribution, we came up with a couple of options.
Yeah.
One is weighting it a little or a medium amount or a lot toward where existing employment is.
Okay.
So, existing employment or where the jobs are.
Right.
We recognize that there is a jobs housing imbalance when you look at the North County subregion versus the Central subregion.
Right.
San Luis Obispo has more than 2 jobs per home currently. in the region, not the city of San Luis Obispo, but the broader area around San Luis Obispo is what we call the sub-region. In the North County, that's the part north of Cuesta Grade, and all the way up to the county line, Monterey, and all the way over to Shandon, but obviously not the North Coast where the Morro Bay, Cayucas, and Cambria would be. That area has more of a jobs housing imbalance where there's less than one job per home.
Okay.
So here's one area with two jobs per home, and here's another area with less than one job per home.
Yeah.
So looking at that, we thought, and we offer, and our stakeholders actually offered up, okay, let's look at a methodology to weight the distribution based on employment, mm-hmm. a little more and a lot. They ended up in the middle with a little more weighting, and then versus putting it where the housing current population is. Because if we put more housing where the current housing is, we make that imbalance even worse. And what we see is, well, Shell Beach Straits jamming up even worse. We see
right.
Cuesta Grade jamming up even worse.
Right.
And we don't want to have that happen. So we looked at this improving jobs housing balance. We also looked at several unique large statewide employers. One of them, for an example, Diablo Canyon, has several thousand of employees.
Currently.
And,
yes.
And the question is, let's just go with the currently part.
Yeah.
And should we weight the new housing to be based off of the existing employment at Diablo Canyon?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we know that employment's kind of in trouble.
Right.
So
with
to speak.
A plan
yeah.
to disperse.
And,
yes.
and the likelihood of new homes being built near Diablo Canyon for those jobs, well, that's just unlikely that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So we looked at those four unique large employers and identified three options across the board of keeping them in the weighting factors or eliminating from the weighting factors or redistributing their employment numbers across the board again. And I think our stakeholder group landed in the middle again
okay.
and said, well, we'll land in that middle and we'll distribute. We won't take those into account. So there isn't a weighting based off Diablo Canyon, for instance, that suggests more homes should go in the unincorporated county because it's obviously not a city because of Diablo Canyon's employment.
Right.
We wanted to adjust that knowing what's coming in the future.
Okay. I'm following you so far.
That's good.
This is really good. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and you're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX, HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX, HD1 San Ardo, and KSBX Santa Barbara. Our discussion today is about how housing policy affects individuals and community and the important implications of housing policy on all of us on the Central Coast. My guests are James Wordley, Regional Planning Division Chief for the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments, or SLOCOG, and Michael Hopkins Tucker, and I love that you have a hyphenated name, Policy Analyst, People Self-Help Housing. You too can participate in today's conversation. And if you have questions, I really encourage you to call with questions or even comments about our current housing situation. You can call in and be part of our discussion at 805-781-3875. Again, that's 805-781-3875. I want to back up for just a minute. I do want you to really kind of define the role of SLOCOG, how long SLOCOG has been in existence, and you know, kind of who is on this committee that's making these decisions.
Okay.
Yeah,
sure.
Can you do that?
So SLOCOG, in one form or another, has been around for just over 50 years now. We celebrated
that
our
long.
50th anniversary just last.
Nice. Happy anniversary.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I haven't been around that long.
Oh, no, I noticed that. Yeah.
But SLOCOG is a regional entity. That means, again, we work with our partner agencies, the seven cities, the county. We also work with Caltrans and public transportation providers. Our main focus is transportation. We have a state designation of Regional Transportation Planning Agency, and that allows us to receive state funding to distribute to our partner agencies to improve transportation in the region. We also have a federal designation of Metropolitan Planning Organization, and that allows us to receive federal funds to distribute for transportation improvements in the region. Now, each of those designations also comes with strings attached, meaning when a RENA cycle comes along, the state turns to us and says, here's your units. You guys distribute these units among your jurisdictions,
yeah,
and acting as the middleman. That's what we do for the RENA.
Okay.
One of the big things we've been working on lately is the Regional Transportation Plan that looks out 25 years. It's a federally and state mandated process that we have to redo and readopt every 4 years.
Right.
We have an RTP draft plan out right now for review on our website.
And that's a regional transportation plan.
Regional transportation plan.
Okay.
We will have the EIR up in early next week for review as well. And that plan looks at all modes of transportation. So, yes, we focus on highway, streets, and roads, but also public transportation, active transportation. We look at maximizing system efficiencies. And by that, I mean van pools, carpools, mm-hmm. park and ride lots. Every car that gets off the road is another car that drivers don't have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
We also look at rail, aviation, harbors, and freight.
And as the county becomes more expanded in terms of where people are living and driving from to find affordable housing, that role of the transportation plan also expands, correct?
It does, and that's why with the plan and with the RENA, we hope to see a improved jobs housing balance so that there isn't greater congestion on our major freeways and thoroughfares.
Yeah, okay. I get that. And then I'm going to go to you too, Michael. Can you talk a little bit about people's self-help housing, what your role is in all of this, and how long you guys have been around?
Absolutely. Actually, incidentally, we've been around almost 50 years this year as
well. Well, look at you guys.
100 years between us.
Isn't
that and so we've been building affordable homes and providing supportive services on the Central Coast for almost 50 years. And we have 52 multifamily affordable housing developments and about over 1,000 single family homes as well, which are funded through a variety of different programs. And then of course, you know, we have expansive supportive services as well, because really it's building the bricks and mortar is just the start. And so providing opportunities for people to get a hand up is critically important to our central mission. And so we have after school care programs, we have college preparedness programs, along with a wide variety of wraparound services to help people not just find an affordable home, but have opportunities to succeed as well.
And then how do your two agencies fit in to this broader picture of this state plan that's kind of saying this is how many units need to be built?
So SLOCOG will go ahead and decide that distribution process. Local jurisdictions will decide through that housing element is basically a plan on not only zoning and capacity, but also policies on how that jurisdiction is going to go ahead and facilitate the development of those units. Because, you know, it's often said local government, state government, they aren't in the business of building housing. However, they are the most important gatekeepers in the process, right? They can't determine market whims and who is going to come to them. But what they can do is make it easy when the right type of development is going to come in that'll serve the community in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
They can facilitate that. And so jurisdictions can develop policies that foster that kind of positive development
when it's
affordable for more vulnerable members of the community, or just, you know, regular market rate development as well.
Okay. Okay, great. And we have a call from Todd's from Arroyo Grande. So I'm going to bring you in, Todd. Todd, are you there?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. What a great conversation you all are having.
Oh, good. Good.
On.
Hey, do you have a comment, question?
A couple, yeah. I mean, I've lived here for 15 years, and one of the things is, yeah, I've noticed there really isn't any low-cost housing. I mean, respectfully, you mentioned 52 units recently, and then some of that formula of jobs and wages and the reference that you go for middle and high on that scale,
mm-hmm.
that really doesn't cut it for low-income housing. I mean, what would be the medium income for the county would be more appropriate for low-income housing? An example would be over in San Luis Obispo by Tank Farm Road. There's a bunch of units, and those are going to be $750,000, $800,000.
Yeah.
Very small percentage of people are going to be able to afford that. And the density is ridiculous.
Yeah.
So it seems to be a taxation issue. You have all these cities with really no way to generate money except through residential taxation. Another point would be how many people in this county actually live in this county. I think the percentage would be in the 50%, where most people are from inland or somewhere else, and this is a second home. Cal Poly would be a great example.
Oh, I see homes. I see what you're saying.
Being for sale.
You mean
there,
homeowners.
Right? And part of the selling strategy is you can rent it out. Well, what does that mean? So you can charge four times what your actual mortgage payment is? I mean, there's some inequity there. And some of those formulas don't really reflect on the lower income side. So taxation would be the main thing, right? So if you have a higher valued home, you're going to get more tax base, and you're going to keep the homes in the surrounding area at that tax base. So there's a conflict of interest there.
Michael, do you want to address this?
Yeah, so Todd, I'll try to do my best to at least address the low-income housing side of that question. So as a part of this RENA distribution process, regional housing needs allocation, it's actually, there's breakouts within those RENA numbers. So it's not just here's how many housing units you need to produce. It actually breaks it out by you need to produce X amount of extremely low income, X amount of low income, X amount of moderate income, X amount of above moderate income. So it does break out different kinds of housing production by income type and what would be affordable to those households. So, you know, and that's where developers like People Self-Help Housing and other nonprofit builders come in, as we are specifically targeted with reaching that extremely low income side that just simply is not met by the market just due to the extremely high cost of land, labor. I mean, you name it. It's, you know, again, as a nonprofit developer, we can wear both hats, as we're very mission service oriented to serve the most vulnerable people in our community. But we understand the cost challenges because we have to compete in the private market for land, mm-hmm. for labor, for everything else that's associated with development. So to answer your question,
I get that point respectfully, but I've seen some of that multi-use that you're talking about, and it seems like the low-end side, like, you know, there's a low, medium, and high. So the low-end side is the smallest percentage. And if you're going to give out or, you know, allow for building, you know, I think that percentage needs to come up more respectfully.
I mean, I won't disagree with you there. It's actually,
cool.
Well, there's
right. I mean, we all know this. I've been here 15 years, and it's pretty ridiculous.
I mean, I can actually quantify it. So we talked earlier about what's considered affordable is 30% of your income, right?
And that's, yeah, you mentioned
that's so roughly in San Luis Obispo County alone, there's about 24,000 households. That's not people, but just households that pay over 30% of their income on rent. We can go a step further and say how many people pay over 50% of their income on rent, and that's almost 13,000 households in SLO County alone. So, you know,
right.
These,
so my understanding is there's about 500,000 people in the county, and I would respectfully say 40, 50, 60% are paying 50 to 60%. So that I would question those numbers respectfully. I mean, I know quite a few people that are barely making it. And this jobs thing, I mean, when you quantify jobs, I mean, most of the jobs here, I'd say 40, 50% are low-income jobs. So near impossible. And then you're caught up into this conundrum of renting, which you haven't even touched on, which, you know, respectfully, but that's even more. I know people that are paying 80% of their income just to live here. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, sorry.
Go ahead.
I mean, coming from the nonprofit affordable housing side, I couldn't agree with you more. I think we definitely need to do more to facilitate affordable housing in this community.
Right. If you want services here, then people need to be able to live here, right? I know a lot of people that commute from Santa Maria because it's so much cheaper. But, you know, if you quantify that with gas and wear and tear and the like, I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well,
you know,
you
mentioned Diablo, Cal Poly, you know, these are the big tax earners or whatever you want to call that. Other than that, you know, you have a bunch of medium and small businesses that wage stagnation and high inflation and high cost of housing.
Well, Todd, I'm gonna cut you off here. Your point is well taken and well made, and I've got another caller I'm going to bring in. But thank you for calling in.
Yes, right on.
So, you know, absolutely hearing from Todd about having a lot of challenges for different income levels in different places. And there are a lot of people that commute from outside the county from areas that are being built in Guadalupe now and
absolutely
in Santa Maria because it is more affordable. And we're going to go to Jim. Jim, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Did you have a comment or question?
Yes. I would like to build affordable housing, and it wouldn't bother me to have them deed restricted. But I don't quite know how to do it. I have two lots that are right next to each other on Creston Road. One is Zone R1, and that's an empty lot. The other one is a very old house that's in terrible condition, tear-down condition, and that's Zone Commercial. So obviously they have to be rezoned, but I don't quite know how to go about doing that, let alone get the accommodations for affordable housing.
So I think you're in the city limits. Is that correct?
Yes.
So you'd work with the city of Paso Robles and just go into the main building and ask for help. That's the easiest way to start.
In the planning department.
Department,
your organizations wouldn't be appropriate for me to deal with?
I would actually say I know you can at least reach out to People Self-Help Housing, and we'd be happy to talk to you about what that process looks like to develop affordable housing.
Okay.
Do you want to give him your phone number so that he can call you?
Sure.
Okay.
Be happy to do on.
Yeah, go ahead and give it to him on the air.
All right. So my work phone is 805-548-2341, and feel free to reach out to me, and I'll put you in touch with the best person to talk to within an organization.
548-2341.
Correct.
And you're going to be talking to Michael.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Right. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Jim. And you are listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your public radio station from Salinas to Ventura, and on the web at kcbx.org. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. James Worthley, Regional Planning Division Chief for the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments, or SLOCOG, is here with me today, along with Michael Hopkins Tucker, Policy Analyst for People's Self-Help Housing. They've been sharing information about how housing impacts individuals and also talking about their agencies and how they're involved in some of the state housing policies and how it filters down to the Central Coast. Today's show is live. We've been hearing from some of you and with your questions or comments. And if you want to call in with more questions or comments, you can do that by calling us at 805-781-3875. Again, 805-781-3875. So I want to get back to talking a little bit about the state's mandate. How long has that been happening?
Oh, we're in our sixth cycle, okay, starting up right now. So,
each is for 10 years?
Well, we started off with 5.5-year cycles. So
okay.
We haven't been doing it for 10 years now, or for 50 years now.
Okay.
But we've just been thrown the new mix, trying to get us onto an 8-year cycle.
Okay.
So that aligns with our every other 4-year RTP.
Is the
this
state
time,
going to an eight-year cycle,
so
the, down
our,
from a 10?
The larger MPOs and regional transportation planning agencies are moving towards this 8-year cycle.
Okay.
So Santa Barbara is a couple years behind us, and Monterey is a couple years behind us to develop their RENA plan.
Uh-huh.
We're working on ours now, and it will be an 8-year cycle. However, because we were off cycle with our regional transportation plan, they gave us 10 years worth of projections to cram into our 8-year cycle.
Once that Board of Individuals makes the decision, the REMA group, right?
Well, the RENA group is just local agency staff.
Okay.
But then our SLOCOG board, uh-huh, it makes the final decision,
okay,
and they're made up of one city council member mm-hmm. or mayor from each of the seven cities, okay. plus all five of the Board of Supervisors.
Okay. So they're discussing then about the distribution of these different 1,100 units approximately.
The 10,800 units.
Okay.
And then down to an annual amount of almost 1,100 units.
Okay.
Yeah.
And really looking at where the distribution would be and what cities.
The distribution is between the seven cities and the county.
Okay.
So we have eight jurisdictions. And we're not looking at where the housing units would go within each one, but just to each jurisdiction.
Okay. And then once that is decided, what is the next step?
So really the next step for us is a draft plan that we would put out in June and then a final plan later at the end of this calendar year. But the next step really starts off soon with the development of each jurisdiction developing their own housing elements to identify where those units can be or might be accommodated.
Okay. Okay. And then from there?
From there, it goes, the question is who's going to jump on?
Who builds it?
Who builds it?
Well,
the developers have to
want
to build it.
No, that was a question.
That's what I asked.
Who builds it?
Who builds it? And the local
agencies. And you don't have that answer because you step out at that point, right?
We step out even before the housing elements are done.
Okay.
Once we do the RENA plan, we're out of it. But we will help review housing elements and see if they fit with our regional transportation
okay.
plan.
So I know People's Self-Help Housing is one of the building entities that
Correct.
Comes in. So from a who builds it standpoint, how is it determined then?
It's a mixture and frankly mostly market rate developers that come in and try to meet that need. And how the low income side is usually calculated is through things like inclusionary housing ordinances, which require market rate developers to include a certain percentage, a variable percentage depending on the jurisdiction, of low-income affordable units. Or they can also pay to an in-lieu fee, which then organizations like People's Self-Help Housing leverage to get the tax credits and other financing that's needed to develop our affordable housing projects. So it's a combination of market rate and nonprofit home builders, nonprofit really targeting on that low income side, and market rate developers typically targeting the higher moderate and above moderate income levels.
So are new builders required to participate in offsetting some of the low income housing needs, or are they incentivized to offset some of the low income housing needs?
The strategies are as variable as the jurisdictions and what they want to do.
And who determines that? Each city?
They actually come up with these policies in their housing elements. So that's where that document's really important is they decide how are these are going to be distributed on specific parcels, but additionally they have criteria or things they're going to do to maybe streamline the development of affordable housing.
So if maybe the permit process,
right,
or rezoning,
correct, or having those inclusionary programs to make funding available for affordable housing developers to come in. And so in some cases. There are some incentives out there, like the density bonus is one of them. Where
what's a density bonus?
You get an allowed increase to your building density if you include a certain percentage of affordable units.
Okay.
And that's actually state law, so local jurisdictions must comply
so
with those
kinds
of density bonuses.
So you could build, say, units with smaller footprints.
Right, and there's a cap on what's allowed
right.
under density bonus. You don't just get unlimited density. It's mm-hmm. Up to 35% of the existing density, but that's contingent upon how many low-income units you include.
Okay. Well, we've got all three lines going here, so let's see about getting some phone calls. We're going to go to Jeff from Pismo. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there.
Hi. Did you have a comment or a question?
Yeah. I've been doing residential development on the Central Coast for probably over 40 years. And I want to tell you the two biggest impediments to bringing homes to the market is one, the fees that it takes. I mean, we're looking at permit fees as much as $100,000 a unit.
Yep.
And, you know, you can't do that's the cost of affordable housing right there.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that is really difficult is how long it takes.
to get through the process?
More regulations all the time, and it can take somebody 2, 3, 4 years to bring a project to construction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very difficult because the developers can't depend on what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're carrying debt in the meantime.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something that I think everybody sitting here at the table has heard, too. And that's a city and a county issue that, unfortunately, we don't have a representative from there that is at this table right now. But as you know, as you were talking about, Michael, as cities are going through this determination, they also need to look at those kinds of issues that are coming from the builders. You know, if it costs a builder, say, $50,000 or $60,000 to build one home, the idea, you know, they're not in it gratuitously.
Absolutely. And this, you know, again, we're in I'm working for a nonprofit, but still a developer. And so we can put on that hat and recognize the challenges that exist due to fees and length of time.
Sure.
And recently, actually, the county, led by the Coalition of Housing Partners, in which I participated, along with the Chamber of Commerce, the Home Builders Association, and other nonprofits, we really try to look at a comprehensive way to address this problem, looking both at the market rate side and the affordable housing side. And we're really encouraged that we got bipartisan support from the Board of Supervisors to look at things like streamlining, fee reduction, really look at the CEQA process as well, was another important one, not with the intention of degrading the environment, but really looking at how consultants are hiring and how that adds time and cost and creating more accountability in that process. And so, you know, I agree, it's something we really need to look at more seriously as a part of this conversation.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up, Jeff.
Sure. Thank you.
Appreciate your call. And we're going to go to Bill. Bill in Agroyo Grande. Bill, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, you had a comment or a question?
I've got a comment and a question. The comment is, I think that we should put a moratorium on building McMansions in this county, which I mean anything over 2,000 square feet, because I think that's one of the driving forces of unaffordable housing is that people come up here from Orange County with $500,000 in their pockets and they want to spend at least that much money on a new house.
I think you're being kind with the $500,000.
Okay, well, anyway, that's a low end. But my question is, how come there haven't been more trailer parks built in the county?
Hmm.
There used to be two trailer parks in Apple Beach that you could throw a rock into the ocean. And there was one almost in downtown L.A., in downtown San Luis.
Yeah.
And they're all gone now.
Uh-huh.
And those used to be affordable places to live.
Mm-hmm. Alternatives.
Funky, but affordable.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I can, you know, I have to say my experience is more with the multifamily type development and single family. I know people, self-help and others in the area, are looking at this as a serious alternative. And there actually looks like there's going to be resources at the state level that'll help in the either the acquisition of maybe a trailer park that's looking to where the owners are looking to sell, and so nonprofits can come in and preserve that, and also potentially funds for acquisition as well to create, you know, a kind of mobile home park. There are some, my understanding is there are some legal challenges in looking at that, and so. It's certainly on the table, and I think, you know, it speaks to kind of a larger trend of people looking for more.
The problem is the prejudice against people who live in trailers, and I think that's pretty deeply set. That nobody wants to live next door to trailer trash, and you know, we have to get over that prejudice.
Well, and I think people who come in and want to build manufactured homes run into the same kinds of issues in HOAs and other situations as
right.
well.
Right, and really, we need to look at all options that are on the table. You know, our housing crisis has reached such extreme proportions. I think we can't say no to any potential solution.
You know, and some of the things that, you know, when I was looking online for San Luis Obispo County's discussions around what they're looking at in reworking to try and address some of the housing incentives, those are inclusive of things like the movable tiny houses that they've been looking at.
What's the difference between a tiny house and a house trailer?
They're smaller.
And they're funkier. And nobody wants to see one.
Well, there is that. Some of them are very cute, actually. Agriculture working housing, worker housing is something that needs to be addressed, too. They're looking at. That's been an issue. Permit fees, accessory dwelling houses, and the inclusionary housing ordinances and affordable housing fund. So I think all of those are in the discussion and are going to have to be looked at by the various cities and the county.
Well, what my worry is when San Luis County is filled up with rich, white, old people, who's going to do the work and mow your lawn and paint your house and do the plumbing, you know?
Yeah.
Not us. We're old.
Right. Or even, getting to the point where your children's teachers can't afford to live here or emergency
Absolutely.
Medical technicians can't afford to live here.
You know what? I used to recruit physicians for a hospital, and recruiting physicians
was tough. It's creeping up.
Yeah.
It's extending far beyond that.
Thank you for calling, Bill. I appreciate your comments.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
And we lost a caller who we'd love to have her call back. So, Kelly, if you're listening to this, Kelly from Arroyo Grande, please do call us back. We'd love to hear from you. And we're going to take a call now from James in San Luis Obispo. Hi, James.
Oh, hello.
Hello. Did you have a comment or question?
Oh, yeah. I appreciate your program today. It's too bad you don't have a local government rep as well.
Yes.
Maybe another time.
I know. We'll bring one on.
Oh, okay. I actually was a candidate for city council in SLO last fall. I'm James Lopes, and I am a retired city planner, so I've been around the block on this a bit.
Welcome to the block, James.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to ask James Worthley a question that about something you brought up, James. You said that the team that created the breakdown of this state allocation for the county team decided not to distribute the needed housing in relation to the large employers. And I just was kind of thrown back on that. Just for instance, in San Luis Obispo, probably the city, the county, CMC, Cal Poly, probably more than half of all the employees at those places can't afford to live in the city and they commute. Maybe even 80% of employees I've heard at the city don't live in SLO. So it seems like there's an obvious connection here that needs to be made that where the job growth is the greatest, that's where the housing demand is, and these large employers are actually one of the better paying job opportunities in the county. So I'm just curious what can be done about this decision not to relate the housing need to the large employers.
So you're right, James. Good to hear your voice again. I've known you for a long time, actually. When you talk about the large employers you mentioned, let's go down the list of Diablo, CMC, and Cal Poly. Those three are in the county unincorporated area.
Yeah.
And they also are located in areas in the unincorporated area that probably aren't conducive to a lot of new homes being built adjacent to them.
Sure.
So by keeping them in the formula would actually assign more housing units to go into the county unincorporated areas. And those areas that are more likely to build are probably Templeton or San Miguel or Napomo, which are far, far, very far from those three very large employers that added additional weight or additional housing directly into the unincorporated area. So that is the rationale of why we broke out those four large employers, the fourth one being ASH in Atascadero, mm-hmm. because it is a very unique
right.
Institution statewide, not just locally. So we did pull those out.
It's almost like you have these different countries, and you can't talk to one country with the other. It's causing problems from another country. So are you saying that the allocation in San Luis Obispo, for instance, is just in relation to the number of employees in the city?
It goes beyond that.
People who are working inside the city.
It does include that. Yes, it includes some of the housing that's in San Luis Obispo also, but it's more weighted toward the employment within the city limits. But because we treated these four large employers differently this time than in the past, we didn't weight those four large employers to the locations or the jurisdiction that they actually reside in. Even though Cal Poly, most people think probably Cal Poly is in the city of San Luis Obispo because it sits right adjacent to it.
But it is actually
in the county unincorporated right. area. So we're not going to see a lot of housing built
right.
adjacent to Cal Poly in the unincorporated area. Mm-hmm. And we certainly don't want to see the weighting factor produce new housing for Cal Poly in San Miguel, for instance. That doesn't help us reduce traffic or improve our air quality.
Yeah, so are you saying that the allocation for San Luis Obispo will not observe this jurisdiction line? It's going to look at Cal Poly's jobs as part of the mix, the housing need in the city?
Part of the mix, perhaps. I think you could probably easily dig up our staff report from the December or February agenda item on our website, slocog.org, and you can go through the 30 pages of how we landed on the methodology distribute the units.
I'm kind of appealing to common sense here. I'm just looking at a way that the allocations can reflect the local employment demand. You know, the job demand here is in San Luis Obispo is huge. There's 20,000 or more people commuting every day, and they're going to these jobs that are not in the city in a big sense. So I'm just saying that the city's allocation should reflect that, shouldn't it?
It should, and I think it does.
Okay, great. I'm reassured.
Okay. Thank you for calling, James.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Don, we have just a minute, but I wanted to get to your question or comment.
Well, thank you very much. A wonderful program as usual.
Thank you.
And, my question is, I am curious, and I haven't heard it brought up, where do the feds fit in here? I mean, what they have a Section 8 housing and Section 8 certificates and things like that. How do you work together with them? And I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
Thank you. And go
thank
ahead,
you.
Michael.
Thanks for your question, Don. So the feds are pretty indirectly involved. Really, it comes to state and local government to do most of the planning and facilitation of development. However, they do provide resources such as those low-income housing tax credits that I was mentioning earlier. Those are distributed to each individual state to distribute how they want. There's also a variety of different resources they provide. One's called the Home Investment Partnership Program, or HOME for short. And there's another one, the Community Development Block Grants. Part of that can be used for housing as well. All of these are typically used as pass-through funds. So they're sent from Washington to either the state or local jurisdictions, and then those states and local jurisdictions have the ability to divvy them up as they see fit for affordable developers to come in and use to build affordable housing.
Okay, thank you. And Steve, got just a minute for your question or comment.
Thank you. I preceded James in his position with SLOCOG for a number of years on this same process over several cycles, so I have some strong opinions on why it probably won't work, and that is because San Luis Obispo is probably one of the best places to live in much of California, if not the world, and the demand for housing here is so strong that there's a gentrification process, if you will, that occurs. People
right.
with more money are able to buy units, and that keeps driving the cost up, up, and up. And the ability to fund and build these units is so limited, and I won't go into the reasons for that, but you can never keep up. And we have a lot of jobs in the tourist industry as our economy's changed, and those are low-paying jobs. So we're creating employment at the bottom end, and the upper end is where the housing is flowing as a natural process of the economic system we live in. So I try to keep it short because I know you're running out of time. But there are a lot of issues hiding in there.
All right. Thank you, Steve. And Steve makes a good point, too. I want to thank my guests for joining me in today's show, James Worthley. Regional planning. Oh, wait, I've got 2 minutes? Oh, thank you. Thank you. I have one question for you guys. Can we say no to the state? And say, no, we just don't want to do that.
I guess you could, but I don't think it's going to do any good for
us. It won't.
No.
So are there penalties if the county does not comply?
So in 2017, there was a housing package passed by the California legislature and signed by Governor Brown. There was some new financial tools made available for affordable housing, but also part of that was increasing the state's authority to step in mm-hmm. if a jurisdiction has a non-compliant housing element or a non-certified or non-compliant, because there's non-certified means they submitted a housing element that did not adequately meet the needs that were
the
distributed to them.
Yeah.
And then they can be non-compliant by simply not facilitating that development at the end of their housing cycle. So very recently, Governor Newsom sued the city of Huntington Beach, and put kind of 47 other jurisdictions on notice as well.
Okay, so that would be a no. again, James Worthley, Regional Planning Division Chief for SLOCOG, Michael Hopkins Tucker, Policy Analyst for People's Self-Help Housing. Thank you for being here today to talk about the discussion about affordable housing here. And we heard from a lot of people about the challenges. I'll be back next week, and I'll be talking with some people about the collaboration between county health, behavioral health, community health centers, and TEMA to integrate physical and mental health care in San Luis Obispo County. Central Coast Voices has been sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX. This is all made possible through underwriting by Joan Geller Sargent. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and thank you for joining us today, and thank you for your calls.